The Tom Woods Show, episode 727.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're looking for more libertarian podcasts, check out the Jason Stapleton program, hosted by my friend Jason Stapleton. Monday through Friday, get a libertarian take on the news. Check it out at jasonstapleton.com. All right, one of the great rules of the universe is about to be complied with right here before your eyes. And that rule is, if you write a book called Ex Neocon, you are going to wind up on the Tom Woods Show at one time or another. And that's, of course, what our guest has done, Scott McConnell. Scott moved in neoconservative circles for quite some time. He was editorial page editor of the New York Post and wrote widely for example, Commentary, National Review, and so on, but then became a founding editor of the American Conservative magazine, which was self-consciously founded as an anti-neoconservative publication. So I'm glad to have Scott on the show with us, linking to the book, of course, at tomwoods.com/727. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
As soon as I found out you had a book called Ex Neocon, I thought, well, look, this is a natural. This thing's a definite. So I was glad to get it. And I was actually sitting in a bar the other day, not drinking alcohol, and I had a lot of time in my hands. So I sat down and read this thing. I thought, I'll skim it and find some good items in here. And I just couldn't. I couldn't do anything other than read the whole thing. I just couldn't. I was just drawn into it. And I emailed you from there and said, well, I'll just put it this way. I said, doggone it, you are a good writer. I mean, it really totally drew me in because it is a collection of essays, but they cohere around a theme. And of course, the theme is Ex Neocon. I love the fact that there's no subtitle. It's just totally in your face. Ex Neocon, period. Even though the publishing world is enamored of subtitles, you don't even give them one. All right. So you have a title like that. You're going to have to answer this question. How did you become an Ex Neocon? In fact, let's start with, how'd you become a neocon to start with?
Yeah, that's the thing, because when I was a young person in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, I was kind of a Gene McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy, you know, McGovern, anti-war Democrat, and my parents were left of center. And then I became anti-communist in the mid-70s. I had actually spent a year in Vietnam, but I became, by the mid-70s, increasingly anti-communist. And I began reading Commentary and, you know, the odd, you know, op-ed piece in the Times by Midge Dector, and it very much spoke to me. And I also had professors at Columbia who were sort of the anti-communist social democrat generation, Europeans, and they were the most impressive intellectuals I had come across, right? And impressive men. So, you know, I worked for Carter, but by 1980, I voted for Reagan and began writing for Commentary in the early 80s when I was working on my dissertation. And it was a thrill to get published there. You know, I liked their foreign policy views, and their views on domestic politics appealed to me too. I mean, they seemed to me suitably right-wing without being kind of quirky or eccentric, like tough-minded, but not, you know, George Wallaceites or something like that. And that, you know, and I was a New Yorker, and probably the Jewish cultural aspect of the neocons was, you know, kind of more appealing to me than my, you know, own group of sort of desiccated wasps. So, you know, for those reasons. And so for most of my young manhood, you know, I got a job eventually at the New York Post. I worked for a while for Irving Kristol's National Interest. And you know, I identified completely with them. So how did I become X?
Well, actually, before you go on, it's occurring to me that I've had a lot of people start listening to the show only recently, and I don't want to assume everybody knows what the term neocon means. We all use it, and we assume everybody knows what it means, but how would you define it?
Well, it's an intellectual group of people who used to be ex-Democrats, and sometimes before that, you know, generations ago, they were on the further left, you know, mostly urbanites, I would say, you know, half or more Jewish in their inception, who left the Democratic Party kind of out of the feeling the Democrats had gone left out of the 60s, and they migrated to the Republican Party and to the conservative movement, and they became increasingly influential within the conservative movement, you know, and then bit by bit they began pushing people out or marginalizing or people, other people in the conservative movement, so that they are now, you know, pretty much hold hegemonic positions in the like major think tanks and magazines and stuff of the Republican Party. But this was a long and slow process. But it, I mean, it wasn't like William Crystal, who's the editor of an important magazine, the Weekly Standard, is, you know, the son of Irving Crystal, and, you know, John Podoretz is the editor of Commentaries of the Summit, Norman Podoretz. And Irving and Norman Podoretz used to be, well, I mean, Crystal's been a Republican for a long time, but they used to be Democrats, and then they became Republicans and conservatives, and then they became the major tastemakers of conservatism.
Well, I get the sense from your book that you hold Norman, even now, in higher regard than you do John.
Well, sure. I mean, everybody does. I mean, Norman is...
And Irving versus Bill, likewise.
Yes. I mean, they're kind of really top-level intellectual battlers. You know, they're from, you know, modest backgrounds. They're smart. They're energetic. They never got bored with their work. And, you know, I mean, it's classical tale that, you know, sons of successful people are, you know, seldom... you know, they usually are not rise to the level of their fathers. And, you know, I mean, John Podoretz, you know, Bill Crystal is a kind of talented, smart political entrepreneur. John Podoretz would be, you know, have a very average career were he not Norman's son, don't you think?
Yeah. I don't think there's any question about either of these things. And especially, my gosh, that track record that Bill Crystal has on being so overwhelmed. I mean, it's not an urban legend that he's just overwhelmingly, consistently wrong about really important things. And I do want to get to the chapter in your book about the Weekly Standard's war. I mean, that really was a chilling essay to me. But so let's go back. So what gives you second thoughts? What is there in the neoconservative message, the specifically neoconservative one, that makes you think, I'm not so sure I belong among this group anymore?
Well, there were two issues. I mean, sometime in the 90s, I found that I was increasingly sympathetic to the it's time for the United States to slow down immigration. I mean, essays which began being published in National Review when it was edited by John O'Sullivan and stuff like that. And I learned a lot about immigration. And I thought, you know, I'm not a nativist or a xenophobe, but, you know, we could have a kind of a nice slow down or pause and assimilate this big dose of new immigrants that has come over from the 70s and the 90s. And the neocons were really, really not amused. I mean, they were actively hostile to, I mean, they to a surprisingly shocking degree, they fought to marginalize people who thought that we should slow down immigration and, you know, tried to get them fired from their jobs, literally, in many important cases, including O'Sullivan's. And it seems so odd to me because they were quick to, you know, wield out, you know, left-wing terms like, you know, racist, bigot, xenophobe. And they were, you know, also at the same time, you know, passionate supporters of Israel. And it never occurred to anyone to say, well, you support exactly the kind of ethnic solidarity for Israel very passionately that you oppose for the United States. And, you know, why is that? So that, you know, you don't like, it would be kind of hostile to say that to people who are your friends and colleagues. So you don't say it, but, you know, eventually, you know, it comes out and, you know, of course it, so, you know, by 2000, I worked for Pat Buchanan's campaign and Buchanan had been a kind of early opponent of the neocons, a premature anti-neoconservative. And that pretty much ended my association with neoconservatives. And then after 9/11, it was clear to all Buchananites and a few other people that the neocons were going to try to use America's kind of anger and desire for revenge and need to strike back at somebody to pursue their own agenda, which was like taking out a lot of Middle Eastern states, which they did. And that's where the Iraq War came from, or, you know, one of the big reasons, the big contributing factors to the Iraq War.
Well, let's take Pat Buchanan for a minute, because Pat had been just by coincidence, had been in the neocons corner on the subject of the Cold War.
Yes.
And he had very much defended Israel because the Soviets were on the side of the Arab states by that point. So you had to defend Israel, and he supported Nixon to the hilt in, you know, 73 and all that. So what happened to make somebody like Pat and somebody like you look at the U.S.-Israel relationship again and say, wait a minute, it's not really sure how the U.S. benefits from this, and it's not clear that, frankly, whether the U.S. benefits from it is the issue the neocons are concerned about. Yes, I dare say that maybe that's not the top priority they have in this relationship.
Well, Israel was a much more, you could make the case for it being a useful ally during the Cold War, as a sort of advanced military state that was, on America's side. Once the Cold War was over, then the fact that Israel was, occupying land that it had no right to and was oppressing the original people there, the Palestinians, rises in importance. And that, I think a lot of people began to notice that in the 1980s, maybe with Israel's invasion of Lebanon or the first intifadas, the Palestinian, civil uprisings in the late 80s. And Pat was one of those who began noticing in the late 80s. And I think he began saying, there really should be a Palestinian state, which is something that American diplomats or any Middle East experts have long said, but which, conservative commentators did not. So he was, as in so many cases, early on with, a kind of courageous position. And, maybe for that reason, Pat was also an early opponent of the first Iraq war, which though I had my doubts about it, was not. But, Buchanan is, I think, a major, trail breaker for a lot of other people. I mean, he was 10, 15 years ahead of me on all these questions, but I eventually moved in his direction.
All right. What do you say to people who say Israel is fighting the same battle we are? That regardless of whether you like the way Israel was founded, whether you like the way the refugees were dealt with, that's all water under the bridge. Today, they are fighting off the same kind of people who want to come here and do us harm. So put aside all your difficulties or the kind of arguments the State Department made in the old days, forget it. That's from another world. Right now, you have to decide, are you on the side of civilization or are you on the side of the savages? That's how the neocons would put it. How do you answer that?
No, I think that's a very interesting thing to parse because, and I have to admit in the last few years, it's hard to care as much about Israel-Palestine when there's so much else going on in the Mideast that is terrible. And so, and also there's a problem with violent Islamic fundamentalism, which is terrible, which is savage, as you say. So I would say a couple things. First, Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people. Palestinians are not like the most radical Muslims around. I mean, the Palestinians as a people were, had a big Christian population and still have a large Christian population and a big secular Muslim population. I mean, Israel wasn't fighting them because they were radical Muslims. They were fighting them because they were people who happened to live on the land that Israel wanted. Secondly, Israel, in terms of its actual policies, is not really interested in fighting radical Islam. I mean, they are very much against Iran, which is not a radical Islamic state. It's a different strand of Muslim. And they're very much against Assad, who's not any kind of radical Muslim. And I think there's even been various Israeli commentators and generals who say, what's the problem with ISIS? Why is that a problem for us? And in fact, ISIS is kind of good for Israel because it makes the point that's in your question that, it's Israel against the savages. But, Israel doesn't have, Israel has a different strategic situation than the United States. It's, and I think, the worse the better is the way Israel views the Islamic world. So, and the more internal tensions and stuff, there, which there certainly are now. I mean, there's no Arab state which is, any threat to Israel at all right now.
Now, I don't want to focus entirely on the Israel and Palestinians question, but when you say things like Israeli oppression of the Palestinians. It's like, I feel like you do have to justify that. So when somebody says that, there is the response that, look, the Palestinians have more representation in the Israeli government than Arabs anywhere in the Arab world have in their governments. And you have a much more open society and this and that. And so what are they complaining about? I mean, let's be reasonable here. Israel is the most civilized country in the region. It's the best quality of life these people can hope to get. Now, I'm talking about within Israel proper.
Yes.
So what do you say to that?
Oh, well, I think there's some validity to that point within Israel proper, in that Israelis of Palestinian origin have a certain amount of civic rights in Israel proper. And I'd say their situation is, you know, probably better than that of American blacks in the 40s and 50s. But it's certainly not equality in terms of, you know, Palestinian politicians who are in the Knesset are sort of like a world apart. They are not, you know, they don't make coalitions with other parties, and the other parties would not make coalitions with them. So there's something kind of formal about and meaningless about their ability to dissent. And but, you know, their situation is not terrible. The thing is that most of the population does not live in Israel proper. Most of it is either in the Gaza Strip, which is under an extreme blockade, or in the West Bank, which is simply occupied territory where the people have no real political rights at all. And, you know, no right to like build a house or, you know, without, you know, going through essentially Israeli government control. And Israel takes their land or takes parts of their land kind of at will. So if you're talking about, yeah, yes, it's the 15% of the Palestinian population, or I think that's a rough figure, in Israel proper, has a certain degree of the civil rights that that Israelis have. And I mean, that's a good thing. There, you know, the radical position on the Israeli-Palestinian position, which I don't actually have, is that there should be one democratic state for all of Israel and Palestine, which I don't think this is a very viable shot, but it's that, all right, let's have Palestinians and Israelis in the West Bank and in Gaza all live in one state and all have same civil rights. But I don't think it's not likely to happen, but that is a possibility, I suppose. The one state solution, it's called.
I have a friend who, I mean, he is a friend, and he's a Zionist. I know a lot of people who are Zionists. But this friend came out and said to me, look, these people are the consummate savages. How can you possibly have sympathy for them? And that was just the way he put it. It was just that way. And it's a person a lot of my listeners like very much. And he just said, these people are savages. How can you not see that? Why would your sympathies possibly be with them? That was his response. Now, is that something you encountered in neoconservative circles?
Well, not quite in those bald terms, but you did encounter, like, I mean, somebody told me that Norm Podoretz at a sort of semi-private dinner, I mean, or made a joke about, you know, that Israel or someone should bomb the Aswan Dam, even if it resulted in millions and millions of deaths, which you wouldn't necessarily joke about killing millions and millions of any other people. You know, the neoconservatives know that the Palestinians are not savages. I mean, the neoconservatives want Palestinian land, but they don't have really any. I mean, they know the Palestinians are, you know, were probably a more secular, advanced, you know, bourgeois Mideast people than, say, you know, Saudi Arabians or something like that. But Israel wants the Palestinians' land, so, you know, whatever is useful to say about them, they will say, whether they believe it or not.
All right, I want to talk about recent, semi-recent, let's say, endeavors, but first let's thank our sponsor. Folks, I know there's a major pain point in your life, and that pain point comes when you look at your device and you are out of Tom Woods Show episodes. What to do other than despair? Well, how about checking out the Jason Stapleton program? Monday through Friday, Jason gives you a libertarian overview of the news. A lot of people are on me to do more current events. That's what Jason does every single day for an hour. So you get current events, economics, and politics from a libertarian perspective. The Jason Stapleton program is one of the fastest growing libertarian podcasts in the world, with over 20,000 daily listeners. Download the show today on iTunes or Stitcher or your favorite podcasting app, or visit jasonstapleton.com to find out more. Jason says give him 10 episodes and he'll make you a more informed libertarian. Take that challenge at jasonstapleton.com. Jason's a friend and a booster of my show, so check him out at jasonstapleton.com. Let's talk about the American Conservative magazine, which you had a hand in from the beginning. That was a self-consciously anti-neocon project. So tell me what was going through your head and how you were brought on board for that.
Okay. It was clear to me when working in 2000 Buchanan campaign, where I worked as an aide de pad and a drafter of some speeches and general muckety muck, that there were a lot of intellectuals who were conservative and not necessarily represented in the media market. I mean, there was and didn't have access to a lot of places to publish. I mean, there was Chronicles, which is a good magazine, but I thought there was perhaps space for something that was more linked to policy. Maybe I almost forget the right way to describe the difference of how I describe Chronicles and TAC. And then I was friends with Taki Theodorakopoulos, and I know he was wanted to do some kind of publishing project, and we had talked about he would invest some money and I would do some work with New York Press, but that didn't work out. And then I said, well, and I didn't really have any great idea how Taki could start a magazine by himself, but I said, look, why don't we, I know Pat, I know Taki, we could, start a magazine together that would, and all these questions were coming up in the year before the Iraq War. It was sort of clear that this big push towards war, and there were a fair number of conservative intellectuals who were just skeptical about this and knew it. So anyway, I got introduced Pat and Taki and said, we came to an arrangement about joint ownership of the magazine, and we got it started. And the niche was that at a time when all the conservatives in the country were gung-ho about invading a country that had nothing to do with 9/11, there would be a voice saying no. And that, as the ridiculousness of George W. Bush's Iraq policy became clear, that voice would grow from something very small to something more significant and more respected.
Well, now there's real turmoil on the right. There's a complete upheaval with Donald Trump at the center of it. But it's more than that, really. Even if there hadn't been, Donald Trump is a symptom of something deeper.
Yes.
And Donald Trump is not really, as we can all see, very ideologically clear. Yeah, I think even in his own mind, I think he has some basic sense of where he stands, but he's certainly not a Scott McConnell, and he's not a Tom Woods in that sense. But there is a group that has arisen recently. And I think you know what I'm talking about, the so-called alt-right. These people are not quite the same, although there's an overlap in a Venn diagram between them and the paleoconservatives. They really are an entity unto themselves, and I know I need to do at least one episode on them. I just don't care what people say anymore. I have enough listeners that I just don't – doesn't matter to me. If I cover a sensitive subject and somebody's too much of a snowflake to listen anymore, then go. Just go. This was not the podcast for you to start with if I can't talk about interesting subjects. So I know I've got to do a whole show on that. But I'm curious to know your thoughts about this group known as the alt-right.
Yeah, I know some of the people involved. And the person who's credited with coining the term, I don't know correctly or not, Richard Spencer, was for 6 months an assistant editor of TAC about 9 years ago. And I recently was interviewed by Mother Jones about him, and it's true we let Richard go because, despite the fact that there being a Venn diagram, I think he was going in a different direction. The alt-right, I guess, puts white identity, front and center in it to a degree which just seems, it's just not me, and it's not most of the writers at TAC, and it's not Pat Buchanan particularly, for that matter, either. And they're probably more skeptical. I think that implicit in their in their ideology is that America has failed, and that multiracial, multicultural states are doomed to failure. And I don't, you know, I'm not there, and I hope I don't ever get there. Though it's, you know, you can certainly imagine scenarios under which their vision, which would be probably a pretty unpleasant and violent vision, would come to pass. But yes, I mean, I know some of those folks, and I think, you know, the way I describe the differences are the way they are. But yeah, you know, they're part of a Venn diagram. There's an intersection between them and the paleos. Yes.
I guess what seems reasonable to me about them is that what they're fundamentally questioning is the neocon Straussian line that the United States is a propositional nation. They're questioning whether there really can be such a thing as a propositional nation. It sounds in principle like that should work, that everybody settles at a particular place and they all agree to adopt, they've all adopted the same philosophical views. Now, first of all, that's a huge assumption, because that doesn't really seem to work that way, especially when your policy is to invite people from all over the place who have radically different views from you. And even Thomas Jefferson thought that was a dumb idea. I thought, why would I want to encourage and make it part of the identity of my country that I encourage people from the old world, even fellow Europeans, to come here when they have no experience living in a free society? So, but anyway, the idea of a propositional nation, that we can all just live together on the basis of ideas, and will that work, and will it not degenerate into people think of themselves in terms of race and their background, and they agitate for state benefits on that basis? Will it necessarily degenerate into that? Maybe it will. I mean, that the state poisons everything.
Yeah, I think they're certainly right about propositional nation being a very weak gruel to keep a nation together. I mean, the Soviet Union was in a way a propositional nation, and that collapsed. And I think they're right about that. I mean, there are people who are not as say racially conscious as the alt-right, who, you know, questioned the idea of a propositional nation and just realized implicitly, as of course, you know, any real person does, that it's easier to have a polity if there's some, you know, naturally shared backgrounds, values, you know, religion, or, you know, religiously generated, you know, values and assumptions about how to live. And sure, it's easier if people, and, you know, and the, that political science truism that I'd rather be a minority in my country than, you know, me to be a minority in yours is, you know, probably universally true.
What I appreciate about them is their visceral, and this is not a blanket statement, because some of them are crazy the same way some of my libertarians are crazy. You know, that's the way it is. I mean, if you go to the Libertarian Party convention, you're going to see some crazy people. That's just the nature of things. I bet I'd find a lot of crazy lunatics at the Republican convention. So I don't hold that against them. But they puncture these thoughtless Orwellian slogans like diversity is our strength. Well, in some situations, you could see diversity being your strength, like in your book collection. Maybe you don't want to have all science fiction. You know, maybe it would be better for you to branch out. But I'm not necessarily sure that diversity is always my strength. I mean, maybe if I lived in on a street where half the people wanted to kill me, that wouldn't be a strength. Maybe I'd want to have more people who were like me. There's nothing a priori about that. But unfortunately, the left believes that is an a priori statement, that diversity is your strength. But it's, I mean, doesn't that sound like it came right out of 1984?
Yeah, it does. No, the alt-right's lack of deference to political correct platitudes is one of the more refreshing aspects about them. And in that sense, they sort of remind me of, you know, radical leftists or yippies or something when I was, you know, growing up and a young person. It's like you just say the most extreme things and you don't give a damn about what, you know, the conformist or the respectable attitude is. And that's probably useful in politics generally for some people to be doing that.
All right, it's unfair of me to focus so much on this. Let me get back to your book. I want to ask you a couple more things before I let you go. I found it very interesting, the story of, I think it was Norman Podhoretz, and you went up to him at some kind of a dinner event, and he said something like, you know, Scott, I always liked you, but then you wrote something against Israel, And he made very clear that there would be no discussion between the two of you at the dinner. You remember this incident that I'm talking about?
Well, I do remember. It was a party at Wally Weymouth's house, actually, in probably 2000, 2001. It was sort of in the transition period between when I was a neoconservative and had a whole circle of neoconservative friends and when I didn't have any. And, Norman, I think, has been able to live a life in intellectual and policy circles where they've been effectively able to banish criticism of Israel from acceptable discourse. And, they would like to, it goes on, and they would like to be able to, banish John Mearsheimer. They would like to be able to banish, any, no matter how moderate, Palestinian spokesman and just have them like not exist, James Zogby not exist. And I, in this case, it was Norman I'd known pretty well. I mean, I'd been to his house and he'd been to mine, and we communicated many times on the phone about pieces and stuff. And I liked him a lot, but boy, he got wind of, this is a piece I'd written for New York Press or something, a really obscure, newspaper in New York, but it was obviously like kind of sent around. So he got wind of it and suddenly, oh, Scott McConnell said something bad about Israel. He was very funny about it. Actually, I said, well, what piece are you talking about? And he said, oh, you've written more than one immediately, which I probably had.
But your pieces, though, and I really want to emphasize this. Early on in the book, you reproduce a letter you wrote to David Horowitz. And that letter is very measured and generous and kind. It is not vindictive. It's not angry. There's nothing that anybody, even the biggest hysteric out there, could call anti-Semitism in it. It's extremely measured. And you say, I think maybe you might want to think twice about some of these ideas that you have. That's been the tone that you've taken. In all along, like, you've never been a bomb thrower from what I can see.
No, I'm not a bomb thrower. As far as Israel is concerned, I think under the circumstances, Israel has a right to exist. I just think that they should try to make a fair compensation to the people it displaced, with the Palestinians, who are certainly willing to accept like a much smaller share of Palestine than they, had in, 1920 or 1940 or 1950, 48. And I'm not one of these people who think that, Israel is some, the existence of Israel is some, completely off the wall sin. And because in terms of what's, peoples and nations have done, it's not. But, it did displace people, and those, people have rights or should have political rights too. And, I think anti-Semitism, as far as I know, my life is so integrated and has been always with Jews, I don't think been called an anti-Semite, not by David Horowitz, certainly, and not by the Podoritzes. And that's kind of their, nuclear weapon. But,
Well, one last thing I want to ask you about, because you have this chapter on the Weekly Standard's war, and in there you talk about how successful the Weekly Standard has been, that it's hard to think of a magazine that's had this kind of success, if by success you mean not necessarily financial success, but influence and getting its ideas accepted and acted upon in high circles. So say something about that, the relationship between that magazine and that war.
Well, they had been agitating for a war against Iraq almost from their inception, and certainly from the late 90s onward, meaning like, every couple of months there'd be some cover story about Saddam Hussein is building nuclear weapons, and lots of serious people would be quoted saying, we have to deal with this. And, basically Bill Clinton was not going to start a war with Iraq, and most Republicans weren't either. Even Dick Cheney, it wasn't on George Bush's and Dick Cheney's agenda at all. And then came 9/11, and suddenly, there was the Weekly Standard was the spearhead of this remarkable propaganda effort, which basically said that George W. Bush will be appeasing or surrendering in the war on terror if he doesn't attack Iraq, which, I mean, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, nothing to do with, you know, radical Islam, didn't have nuclear weapons, any of that stuff. But they were able to, I mean, because of a kind of effective part of the Murdoch media network, you know, being TV and think tanks and the magazine, you know, able to essentially sell this notion to Cheney and to the Republican Party and the Democrats, you know, who are basically cowed by, you know, being afraid of being called McGovern Democrats or something like that, mostly went along. Barack Obama didn't, and as a result was elected president. But yeah, the Weekly Standard, what, I mean, is like an intellectual version of, I guess, like the Hearst Press in the, you know, 1890s or something, you know, bellowing for war and getting its way, except the war was really more significant.
All right, make a prediction for us. The neocons have been quite resilient, so even though they're somewhat down at the moment, I wouldn't call them out. Where do you think their movement is going?
Well, they've been endorsing, you know, there's a fresh neoconservative endorsement of Hillary almost every 3 or 4 days of a prominent neoconservative. And I suspect they will try to, assuming that she's elected, which I think is more likely than not, will go back to the Democratic Party, or, and they will also participate, let's say, assuming Trump loses, participate in saying, you know, Trumpism has to be, you know, completely extirpated but from the Republican Party, and we'll try to blame the fact that Trump was not a neocon and said some bad things about the Iraq war and, you know, said some accommodating things about getting along with Putin, and we'll try to stipulate that that's the reason for his defeat and not the fact that he's a kind of undisciplined, inexperienced politician. And so, I mean, they will fight on two fronts: A, to roll back Trumpism within the Republican Party, and B, to get positions in the Hillary administration. And whether they will succeed in that, I can't predict. I mean, I'm sure they will get something in the Hillary administration, and I don't really know, you know, who will push back and how hard.
Well, having said that, we'll draw this to a close. I'm recommending your book. I really enjoyed reading it. Ex-Neocon, it is tantalizingly titled. I'm linking to it at the show notes page for today, episode 727. It's tomwoods.com/727. Of course, you can get it on Amazon. That's but maybe the easier way to remember, just to go to the show notes page and click on it and get it. Scott, best of luck with it, and thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, everybody, check this out. I just got an email from two guys telling me this. They have a website. They are Tom Woods Show listeners who started a website. But listen to what they're telling me. With their new blog, thedakotahomestead.com, we're having so much fun discovering new things, pushing ourselves to explore ideas and educating others. But listen to this. We are also on the ballot for statewide office under the Libertarian Party of North Dakota, public service commissioner and insurance commissioner. We are Rothbardians with planks set on the total abolition of these positions and finding alternatives to government bureaucracies. So on the dakotahomestead.com, we discuss ideas and events that affect the world today, talk about Austrian economics, philosophy, much more, hoping to start a podcast. So it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, as you can imagine from that. So thedakotahomestead.com. Started by a couple of Tom Woods Show listeners, I urge you to check that out. I'm going to link to them as the listener website mentioned at tomwoods.com/727. And just remember, if you want to get a little boost when you're starting a blog or a website, before you start it, make sure it's before you start it, you check out tomwoods.com/publicity. I got lots of goodies for you, but they don't do you no good unless you look at them before you even get started on that blog or website. All right, tomorrow we're going to be talking once again about free trade, because I'm not sure we've quite hit it yet on that subject, because I think that's an area where people say, look, I'm either going to believe my own eyes or I'm going to believe libertarian theory. So which one am I going to take? So we're going to attack this one once and for all. If all goes well, that is our topic for episode 728, and I hope you'll be with me for that.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.